Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Pierce Brosnan talks to me about his new film Giant, where he plays a boxing coach, as well as his long career and acting opposite Robin Williams. I also talk to the film's co-star, the man who plays Prince Nassim, that's Amir El-Masri. Chris Wasser will give us the skinny on the movie everyone's talking about, the Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal movie Hamlet, plus all the week's TV and movies reviewed and dissected. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk, although it's coming to you on the radio this week at the later time of 9 p.m. due to sporting fixtures. Good weekend to you all and Happy New Year. I was here last week, but we did a kind of different show where we were looking at the best Irish soundtracks of all time because the world was kind of half asleep, it seemed. Half the world was working, half the world weren't. So this feels like the first show of 2026 in a certain way. So Happy New Year to you again, if you heard me last week. And I do hope you're doing well. Lots going on in my world as well, including a mouse issue where we had to call pest controllers out. Little so-and-sos, the cold weather. And the person in the company was going, I'll have to get back to you. It seemed where I was living, every house was being overrun with the little pesky guys. But I believe we have it in hand now. Time will tell. They're only mice. They're only doing what they're meant to do, I suppose. Seek warmth. Sure, who wouldn't seek warmth on such a cold week? Anyway, that's what's been floating my boat. But in TV and movies, I was pleased to see, before we get to TV, just in terms of the movies, ComScore have released figures for the top movies of the year last year in the UK and Ireland. Now, it's a combined score between the UK and Ireland, so we can't be sure how much of this is Ireland and England. But I do want to mention the good news was that 1.1 billion were the box office figures. And that was an increase of 1% year on year. And they've gone up every year since COVID. So that's a good sign. It was a small increase, but it was an increase. So they're the highest they've been audience figures since 2019. And it might interest you to know that the top three movies were Minecraft number one, Bridget Jones 2, Wicked 3. Minecraft was good. As a, you know, a movie about a video game. Bridget Jones was great. Wicked wasn't so good, but anyway. But look, people are going to the cinema. That's what matters to me more than anything. I do care about what they're seeing, of course, in the cinema, but I care more that they go into the darkened room and turn off their phones and enjoy a movie for 2 or 3 hours. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
You claimed after your arrest for the assault on Aaron Corval that he had kidnapped her.
I believe he keeps her, kept her, against her will.
She's a drug user, yes?
Is that relevant?
Very much so.
Yes, she is. Look, there was a page before Aaron Corval and a page after Aaron Corval, and they are very different. He's a violent, unhinged individual. Which is why, when he came towards me in the park, I feared for my safety. And if Aaron is dead and no longer in Paige's life, that makes me extremely happy.
You're glad he's dead?
Simon's just stopped, yeah?
Yes, very. And I hope he suffered. And I hope he rots in hell. But I didn't kill him.
Yes, James Nesbitt there, being interviewed there in pretty fierce terms. This is the new Harlan Coben series on Netflix. It's currently number one. It landed on New Year's Day, I believe it was. It's called Runaway. It's 8 parts. There has been Harlan Coben fatigue, I think. The first one, he's this very famous thriller writer whose books have lots and lots of twists in them. The first one on it, he did a big deal with Netflix for adaptations. And the first one, The Stranger, worked very well. To me, they've been diminishing returns ever since then, and they've just become partially ridiculous, and you watch the 6 or 8 episodes and you go, why did I do that? The good news on this one is the juice is worth the squeeze, and there are a lot of things going on in it, but it works, and it ends well, and everything's tied up, and it's perfect January viewing. James Nesbitt plays a man who's looking for his missing daughter, Paige. He's married to Minnie Driver. I won't give you the whole plot. There are many plots. Ruth Jones of Gavin and Stacey fame, who plays Nessa in Gavin and Stacey, is a private detective, a kind of quirky one, who's brought in by a rich guy to go looking for his missing adoptive son. There are two Bonnie and Clyde-like figures who are going around killing people. All these plots come together in quite a pleasing way. And James Nesbitt has reminded us, I think, what a great actor he is. And no one can do Hassled Everyman the way James Nesbitt can. So hats off to him. Run away. It won't change your life. But it is nice January comfort viewing. And we'll get you through many a dark January night. Another show I watched in recent weeks that I do want to mention is Keys to My Life, hosted by Brendan Courtney. And this has been going for a good few years now. And it's where Brendan Courtney brings people back through their lives, through the houses that they lived in. And he brings them around different houses they lived in. And he has the keys to them. And they reflect on their life through the homes that they once inhabited, or the houses they once inhabited, or both, a house and a home. And to great results often. Now, sometimes you could accuse it of being, I don't know, slightly mawkish in that you know people are going to get upset. But I still think it's a great idea for a show. And Brendan Courtney is a great host because he gets out of the way. And I'm mentioning this because there was a special on Stephen's Day for an hour where he had someone in our ballpark, Jim Sheridan, who I've spoken to a few times on the show, and he traced his life through the homes he'd lived in. And it was brilliant, brilliant watching, I have to say. And he took him to New York. He took him back to Seville Place near Sheriff Street. He also took him, and this was something I didn't know, a house he owned in Dalkey that pretty much ruined his life for a period of time because there was all sorts of financial complications with it. And he reflected on his childhood and all sorts of things. It was a great watch, and it's still on the RT player. So do check it out. It's Keys to My Life. The episode with Jim Sheridan was top-notch viewing, I have to say. Now, something else I want to bring to your attention is I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not. And this is a authorised, unfiltered documentary that's now on Sky and Now TV. It was on the 2nd of January it was shown, but it's still up there if you have those platforms. It's one part, I think it's just shy of 2 hours. Chevy Chase, I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not. Now, I eat this stuff for breakfast because it's Chevy Chase looking back on his career from Saturday Night Live to the big movies of the 80s like National Lampoon's, to his somewhat failed talk show, to his later career and things like Community. It's also showing he's a very complicated, at times deeply unpleasant person, it has to be said. Certainly lots of people have complained about him over the years. There's been addictions. He had a pretty horrible childhood, according to him. There was abuse. He doesn't seem very nice at times, even on camera, and isn't nice to people. It's an intriguing watch because he rubbed people up the wrong way and the right way over his career. And it's kind of fascinating to see him being honest and somewhat a little blind to his own failings. And you wonder what he thought, or if he's even watched it back and thought, no, I don't come off too good on this, because he doesn't. But it is a great watch. I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not. Great title. He used to say that when he was on Saturday Night Live. And you will relive some of those movies that he was great in during the 80s. He had lots of flops as well. And his talk show was a spectacular flop that I was vaguely aware of. And so there's some great footage in it as well. But a complicated, strange man. A mercurial comic genius, you might say. Talking of comic geniuses,
I'm a hypochondriac, right? Every morning I wake up and I think, right, what's wrong? Like, I go, what's that? Is that, that wasn't there yesterday. That was, what's that? What's that? And I Google it. I think, what? And I catastrophize as well. So I Google it and the first sort of like five or six, I'm fine with. Like, it goes, could be anxiety. Yeah, could be lack of sleep. Yeah, I didn't sleep. Could be lack of fibre. Yeah, I'll have some more fibre. Could be lack of vitamin B. I'll get it. And then I just keep pushing me. Like, it goes, could be cancer. I go, it's cancer. It's cancer. Once I came out of the bathroom and I went, Jane, I think I've got bowel cancer. She went, we had beetroot last night. I go, oh yeah, cheers.
The unmistakable sound of Ricky Gervais there. That's from his new Netflix show, Mortality. Now listen, I'm not going to get into all this with you. You know Ricky Gervais. You know he can offend a lot of people and he takes no prisoners. His new Netflix show is exactly that. But it is very clever. and it is very funny. Regular listeners might know I'm one of those people that I find it hard to be offended by a comedian in a way. To me, a comedy show is, you know, like a football match, or dare I say it, like being in bed with someone. You can't necessarily be responsible for the things you might say. It's a different way of being in the world. And comedians are like poets. They do different things with language and they get away with more. And you have to bear that in mind when you're watching a comedy special. So if you like Ricky Gervais and you like his trademark humor, you will like this very much. If you are regularly offended by Ricky Gervais, boy oh boy, woman oh woman, you will continue to be offended by him because he jokes about everything. And mortality is only a part of the story, reflecting on his old age or his increasing age as he sees it. He's reflecting on the state of the world and trolls and free speech and even the Golden Globes. And I'll say that phrase again. He takes no prisoners. And in fact, there is a very funny piece about him imagining what might happen to him if he went to prison and he went into the shower at this stage of his life. Man, I laughed. But caution advised, you may be offended. But I was tickled pink. Now I'm talking a lot, but that's what I've been watching of late. Do get in touch if you've been watching any of those shows or other shows you want to tell me about. Screentime@newstalk.com is the email address. And indeed, last week on the show, when we were doing our special about the best Irish songs on movie soundtracks and TV shows, Kevin got in touch to remind me of Jimmy Kennedy, who wrote the song South of the Border, down Mexico Way, used in the movie of the same name. And he was, of course, from Tyrone. And I didn't know that, or I hadn't remembered it. So thank you for that, Kevin. I do, however, remember Tony Soprano singing that very song from that movie to Junior Soprano, his uncle, on a golf course when he was teasing him about, let's just say, a sexual practice. Say no more, Squire. But thank you for that, Kevin, for getting in touch and reminding me of South of the Border. Now, after the break, the one and only Pierce Brosnan talks to me about his new movie, Giant, along with the co-star, the man who plays boxer Prince Nassim, Amir El Masri. That's all to come after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show, coming to you at the later time of 9 p.m. this evening. Now, take a listen to this.
I hate you because you're different. They'll hate you because you're better. Let them. It's the reason the halls are packed for your fights and half dead for the rest. Same every tournament, right? Yeah? Let them hate you. Let them hate you. Never let them steal what's yours, okay? You hear me?
Yeah.
You get what you've earned, what you're owed. You don't ask politely. You take it. You demand it. Respect. Recognition. All of it.
And how do I do that?
Your training every day to their 3 days makes you what?
Better.
So, doubling down and training twice a day will make you what? It'll make you unbeatable. Go on now. Get in that ring.
Yes, Pierce Brosnan there, playing a boxing coach called Brendan Ingle, who stars opposite Amir Al-Masri in the new movie Giant, which is in cinemas on the 9th of January, this Friday, based on the remarkable true story of British Yemeni boxing champion Prince Nassim. To give him his full name, Prince Nassim Hamed, who you probably are well aware of. This movie tells the story of his rise and his relationship with the Irish boxing trainer Brendan Ingle, who Pierce Brosnan plays. It charts Naz's inspiring rags-to-riches underdog tale from very humble beginnings in Sheffield to becoming champion of the world. Prince Nassim, as you may know, had a very unorthodox boxing style. He was also very cocky and he dominated the sport in the late 90s and early noughties. He also faced huge racism and Islamophobia that was sweeping Britain back in the 80s and 90s. Some would say it still is, but he had a pretty rough childhood. And the film explores his relationship, a beautiful relationship with this trainer, Brendan, who came from Dublin, a real life character when he was 15, and worked his way up to becoming this boxing coach who was doing it simply, it seemed, for the love of helping kids. And he took a real shine to Nassim when he saw him apparently running in a schoolyard away from bullies. And the film tells kind of his management of him as a young boy and then their relationship as it grew to Prince Nassim becoming this global superstar. And the relationship changes, as you might imagine. This is a kind of good old-fashioned great boxing movie with a lot of heart. Some people are asking questions about Pierce Brosnan's accent again. That seems to be the way he speaks now, as you'll hear, because I got to have a chat with Pierce Brosnan about playing Brendan Ingle and also Amir Al-Mazari, who plays the grown-up Prince Nassim, and he does it brilliantly. He looks the part, he sounds the part, he's cocky, he's a brilliant boxer. Amir was in such things as The Night Manager, which lots of people are talking about, the movie Limbo and The Crown. So he's a great rising star, is Amir Al-Mazari. You don't need any introduction for Pierce Brosnan, who plays his boxing coach, Brendan Ingle. So here's my chat with Amir Al-Mazari and the great Pierce Brosnan. Greetings from Dublin, Ireland, guys. They saved the best for last. So
That's what they said.
I really enjoyed the film. So I said yes to interviewing you both before. Why wouldn't I? Before I saw the film. And thank goodness it was so good. I'm just wondering, not to psychoanalyze you or anything, but is there any kind of wish fulfillment in this? That I was reading about Brendan this morning. He left Dublin when he was 15. You left Navan when you were 10 or thereabouts, and you 11. Moved to the UK. 11, my apologies. There's a lot to remember. But then, you know, Brendan does all these good things in his life and all you do. Like, was there something about this felt familiar to you?
There was a familiarity. There was a connection and an empathy to Brendan Ingle, who, my middle name is Brendan, Pierce Brendan Brosnan. Mm-hmm. I'm Irish, I'm from Navan. I know what it's like to travel far at that young age of 11, and in my case, to come to London, to be a kind of an outsider, as it were, to be in a foreign landscape, to assimilate, to be able to fit in, to find your place, to kind of let go of a part of your life and your identity to become someone else. I know what it's like then also to try and be a young man leaving school at 16 with nothing but a cardboard folder of drawings and paintings to try and be an artist, and then to find acting in the company of community theatre in South London. Doing street theatre, children's theatre, and to become the artist that I have become. So the writing by Rowan Atherley was so poignantly presented on the page. It was so beautifully embroidered. I knew about Prince Nassim. I'd seen him box. I was there in New York, Madison Square Garden, one of his last fights. So I'd seen the man. I saw the glory of him, but I didn't know anything about Brendan. And again, this beautiful gift came to me, and I said yes to it, and then there was this chasm before me of, what have I said yes to? How the heck am I going to play this man?
Well, you pulled it off.
You know, well, thank you. So that's some of the story. And then working with Amir, whose work...
Let me ask Amir. Sorry, I'm just conscious of our 9 minutes. I could listen to you recount the story of your life all day long, though. Don't get me wrong. Amir, you know, Prince Nassim, as an audience member, we meet him and we root for him. And he's called horrible things as a kid and he's tenacious and we want him. And then he showboats a bit too much as an audience member. That's my sense of it. How do you see him in terms of, you know, where the arrow is in terms of us liking him and not liking him?
You have to champion whatever character you play, whether or not you on the book it's a villain. You have to understand why they made those decisions, and it always comes from something some sort of trauma or trigger, like you've so rightly said, the trials and tribulations that they've both faced, actually. So, you know, I was a massive fan of his growing up, and I wanted to also show him with all his light and shade. And yeah, it was you know, he was a colorful man, as you said in one of the interviews, actually, in the first in the interview that we watched on Sky Sports.
Yes.
Yeah, he was an incredible man, and mm-hmm. but what a treat to play him, and what a treat to, you know, be opposite Pierce and to work with someone who's an incredible actor, and you know, completely transform. Once we got on set, it was like, that's it, this is Brendan, and it really helped elevate my performance as well.
Mm. And you know, I've spoken to a couple of people who have been in boxing movies, and they always seem to say the same thing. I trained like a madman or a mad woman in Sydney Sweeney's case last year. Did you do, because you look in terrific shape in the film, was there an intense week period?
Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. 4 weeks, 12-hour days, just training every single day. I lost about 8 kilos. And then we got stuck in. We got stuck in, and, you know, beyond the training, it's just encapsulating the whole bravado, the cockiness, the swagger, but also finding the nuance between our relationship as well. Mm. And, you know, really, like I said before, it really helps when you're with someone as amazing as Pierce to play opposite, because I saw someone completely engrossed in it, and it really, really helped me, because it's really hard to find that point and that balance on your own. You need every single facet around you to work, and Rowan, this is an incredible director, and the script is a real gift to perform and be a part of.
Sure. Pierce, I read in a well-known English newspaper over the weekend, they were talking about how busy you are lately, and they had this phrase, which might make you smile, or you might think it's incredibly pretentious, a Brosnanascence, basically a Brosnanascence, a play on the Renaissance.
Brosnanascence.
But is it your sense that you're more in demand now, or is that just us looking in, that we've seen you in a couple of high-profile things lately, like Mobland and now this and the Thursday Murder Club? Or what's your sense of your career at this age?
Well, I'm 72 years of age now, so I give thanks up on high for all the years that I've been at the table. I've been an actor since I was 18. And there just becomes a maturity, and there's still a desire and a want to prove to myself that I can make a performance, create a performance. And it's very hard to really describe or try to articulate the reason for this renaissance of the work. I was trained as an actor and was led to believe that I could transform. And then I kind of went to America in 82, and I just kind of played myself for a while. And you kind of, you make work that's commercial. I have a family to feed, and I found work that was commercial and delightful and easy to play. But there comes a time to work. There comes a time to really try and find work that's going to challenge you and to have longevity and to be interesting, to be an unexpected surprise to yourself and to the audience.
Yeah, I think that's where you're at now. Not that you need me to explain your career to you. And just in closing then, you may be relieved to hear, I know people like me get in front of you and they ask you about a very famous spy, but I'm not going to. But the first thing I remember seeing you in was Mrs. Doubtfire. And you played this handsome man who was now dating Robin Williams's ex, in essence.
Yes.
And there are so many stories playing opposite Robin Williams that, you know, he would just come on set and no one could work for an hour because they were in fits of laughter.
Right.
And you were the straight man to him. So I'm just wondering what kind of experience that was to play opposite the great, now sadly departed, Robin.
Oh, it was glorious. It was a cherished time. I remember having to pay the mortgage that year or something like that, and this job came to me. I was such a fan of Robin's work. And then you have Chris Columbus, who, again, gave me the opportunity to work with this magnificent actor. I never really worked with Robin, to tell you the truth, because the first day I got to the set in San Francisco, they said, do you want to meet Robin? He's in the makeup trailer. I said, sure. I went in, and there he was, sitting there in the trailer. He had a Hawaiian shirt on, cargo pants, big hairy arms, but he had the head of Mrs. Doubtfire. He just said, oh, Pierce, you're so handsome. Come here, give us a kiss. Hey, buddy, how you doing? And so I never really worked with Robin. It was always Mrs. Doubtfire. Wow. And it wasn't until the end of the movie that I met Robin Williams.
Wow.
But, you know, if I was only did that in life, I would be a happy man. So to be part of Mrs. Doubtfire is cherished.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm a happy man to talk to both of you today. Giants, terrific, and continued success to both of you. And thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thank you. All the best.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Take Cheers.
Bye bye.
Pierce Brosnan. And also Amir Al-Mazari there, talking to me about playing Prince Nassim and Brendan Ingle, the boxer and the boxing coach, in the new movie Giant. And Giant is in cinemas now from the 9th of January, and a very good kind of rags-to-riches boxing movie it is too. And look, Pierce Brosnan, you heard him there. That's kind of how he sounds now. His accent has become a hard to gauge where it's from anymore, but that's genuinely how he speaks. He's traveled far and wide, and this is how he sounds nowadays. And incidentally, you heard me kind of laugh there when I asked him a question, because you'd only see this on video, but we were on Zoom. When I said to him, I'm not going to ask you about Bond, he gave me the biggest theatrical wink I've ever seen. So he was clearly pleased that I wasn't bringing up Bond. But that's why I was laughing, because Pierce Brosnan giving you a big wink with one of his big eyebrows is something to behold. So that is Giant, which is in cinemas. What's also in cinemas now is a movie called Hamnet, which you've no doubt heard about, and it's getting a lot of Oscar buzz. And after the break, Chris Wasser will be giving us the skinny on it. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema release. Well, Giant was a new cinema release, which is out this Friday, the 9th of January, but also out this Friday, the 9th of January, is, oh, some people are calling the movie of the year, and it's only the 9th of January. I have seen it, but more importantly, Chris Wasser, our erstwhile reviewer here on this show, arts journalist and film critic, has seen it, and I am talking about the movie Hamnet. So let's find out what it's all about. Chris, first of all, Happy New Year and all that jazz.
Yeah, and a very Happy New Year to you, John. I hope you're well.
Indeed I am, and all the better for talking to you. Now, Hamnet, let's take a little flavour of it to get things going.
Anya's way.
I know who you are.
Who am I?
Well, I don't know you, but I've heard
I'm the daughter of a forest witch.
Yes, people say that, but that's
I am
I
my mother's daughter. I've learnt many things from her. What are you looking at?
You.
Why?
I
thought you were a man of words, Master Tutor.
A clip there from Hamnet. I've seen this, as I mentioned. You've seen it as well. I think we're at the same screening before Christmas on a Thursday
yes.
afternoon, if I'm not mistaken, as you feverishly took notes. You were writing down your little shopping list, though, I think you said to me afterwards. So just, you know, there's a lot of buzz about this, but plenty of people might know, might not know what it's about at all. It's Shakespeare themed of sorts.
Yes, that's right. It's strange. A lot of people ask me about this film around the Christmas holidays, and most of the people I spoke to thought it's a Hamlet adaptation, but
yeah.
This film is not Hamlet. If I can give you a clumsy description, it's the maybe story behind Hamlet. You know, it's this semi-fictional tale rooted in real-life historical tragedy, which sort of depicts this unimaginably cruel chapter in the lives of William Shakespeare and his wife Anne, referred to throughout this film as Agnes. But most of the headlines that this film have made are around the fact that it's devastating. for critics and for the few audiences that have seen it. I mean, before I even watched it, I was speaking to people who were lucky enough to have been at the Toronto screening last August or September, I think it was. And, you know, they said they wouldn't be able to, you know, watch it again.
I was sitting in the audience and people beforehand, that screening I was talking about, were saying, are you ready to cry? You know?
Yeah, yeah. And the people, and some of the people who did see it at earlier festival screenings, they were also at that press screening that we were at. And some of them brought tissues.
Yeah.
So, it's only after the film ends that you understand why they came fully prepared, because it is quite devastating. And it does tell, you know, Hamlet, young Hamlet, William and Agnes's son, you know, this little boy did exist and he did die. And historians and scholars, you know, we don't quite know what happened to him. You know, we don't know the full details. It was that long ago, but we know that. Scholars think that his death inspired Shakespeare to write Hamlet. So based on the novel by Maggie O'Farrell, Northern Irish author, and directed by the Oscar-winning director of Nomadland, Chloe Zhao, together, because the two of them worked on the screenplay, they've created this scenario where, you know, it is saying, yes, this horrible, unimaginable grief did inspire great art. And this is sort of their take on the events.
Yeah. So it begins with Willie Shakespeare, as we euphemistically call him, working as a school teacher. And he comes across a lady played brilliantly by Jessie Buckley.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it begins like almost like a routine countryside romance, you know, and it takes us to the muddy Stratford Hills, where you've got this handsome Latin tutor, a fellow named Will, who you might know, played by Paul Mescal. You might know him, too. And he falls head over heels for the most talked about woman in the village. So that's Jessie Buckley's Agnes. So why is she the most talked about woman in the village? Well, he's not too far behind her because everyone thinks, you know, he's a bit of a lazy sod. He's quite distracted at his work. He's always abandoning his students, probably because he doesn't want to be a teacher. He wants to be actually writing. But as far as Agnes is concerned, she's an adult woman who is unmarried and nobody wants to marry her. And this is quite controversial at this time. And everyone thinks she's away with the birds. And they mean that literally because she's this sort of spirited hawk handler.
Earthy.
She is earthy. She's a little bit hippie, John. You know, and she
were there hippies in the 15th century? I mean,
according to this film, there were. Yeah, I mean, there are times where Paul Mescal and Jessie Buckley look as though they've just come straight out of All Together Now Festival. despite the fact, John, that they don't have really all that much in common. Other than the fact that they're deep thinkers and they're attracted to one another, they're just drawn towards one another, and they start a family. They hope to marry. Their families kind of kick back against it. You've got William's glovemaker father, played by our own David Wilmot. He says absolutely not. His mother, played by Emily Watson, doesn't want, again, her son marrying, you know, a hippie. It's only really Agnes's big-hearted brother Bartholomew, played by Joe Alwyn, that says, why not? Yes, I'm going to give the blessing here because, you know, these are two souls in love and that's the greatest thing in the world. So they're allowed to marry. They're allowed to start a family, a home. We get to a point where, you know, Will's off making history in London. Agnes is at home with their children, Susanna arriving first, who's born in the woods, just as her mother planned. And then later, twins, Hamlet and Judith. So you get to a point in this story, John, where you have this perfect family portrait, and the children enjoy this cozy, comfortable life with parents who love them and adore them. No harm can come to this family, and then the bubonic plague arrives.
Yeah,
and that's look, when it all goes south.
It's not a spoiler to say that Hamlet dies, right? Because that's what this whole movie is about.
It's not, no. It's all over the marketing. Yeah. It's all that's talked about in the interviews. I mean, we've mentioned the fact that this is a devastating film. You know, everything I mentioned there isn't quite devastating. Something big happens in the middle of this film, and we know what it is. But an awful lot has been spoken about this distressing middle section, this 5 or 10 minute sequence where basically Agnes watches the life slip away from her little boy. And I don't use the word distressing lightly there.
Yeah.
This scene has been so hyped that I thought it can't possibly be as effective as the people around me are saying. It is. It's one of the most powerful death sequences I've seen on screen. You have this case where Buckley's character is not the one dying here, but she contorts her body in such a way, and this horrifying wail escapes from her. A sound that I just don't want to hear twice. I can understand why some people don't want to see this film a second time.
Well, it's funny that, you know, I remember a similar scream in Sophie's Choice. It's a slightly different movie, but a reasonably similar premise, and the idea of a mother losing a child in some fashion, the noise, and it's actually silent in Sophie's Choice, but it's that emotional whack that you don't want to hear again.
Oh, it's absolutely. And also, as I say, like, she contorts her body in such a way that you think that Buckley is almost going to die on the spot. So it's quite raw. It's quite authentic. You know, and she screams until there's nothing left. And I can't imagine how they even rehearsed such a scene or what that, you know, took out of Buckley. And it's ironic because I'm saying that I don't think I would watch this film again. You know, it's an incredible piece of work, but, you know, there's a part of me that thinks I might just skip that sequence, but it's ironic because I think that sequence will actually be studied.
Absolutely. Years. And I mean, before that though, there's also a scene of her giving birth at one point, which is particularly well acted and powerful to watch, I would suggest. But look, that's the midpoint of the movie and we don't want to give any spoilers and all, but more happens. So what do you want to say about that?
I think it's okay to say that, you know, the second half of the film, whereas the first half is about this family coming together and building this life together, the second half is the aftermath of this, you know, unimaginable loss and what sort of effect that has on these parents and the various coping methods that they apply. I mean, you have this situation where Will does what hundreds, millions of other parents have had to do in such awful circumstances. They throw themselves into their work.
Yeah.
And you have this case where Will goes off to London and he creates his most, you know, accomplished dramatic piece, Hamlet. You know, he's inspired. He turns his own personal anguish into this, you know, triumphant piece of art. But Agnes at home can't believe that he's doing this. So we kind of get to a point where the both of them, you know, come together over the creation of this play. Again, that's not a spoiler. This thing is, everybody knows what happens in the film. But I won't say what happens, obviously, in the last 20 minutes when the play is staged. I think performance-wise, look, it is the Jessie Buckley show. And she, you know, she started off the week with a Critics' Choice Award, finished it with a Screen Actors Guild Award, and she'll probably win a Golden Globe, and she will definitely be nominated for and potentially win an Oscar. But also, Paul Mescal, you know, he has taken the back seat because it's more of a supporting turn, but he is terrific here. I mean, like we've seen plenty of screen Shakespeare's, you know, and a lot of films, a lot of TV shows, they kind of paint the bard as cocky and untouchable and, you know, not a real person, basically, you know, sometimes a very annoying man to be around because of his talent. I thought that this was the first time that we've seen Shakespeare treated as just human with all of his little imperfections.
I think I've seen every film and indeed TV show Paul Mescal has been in, and I think this might be his best performance. I completely agree with you about Jessie Buckley. I'm not sure if you actually said she was brilliant in it, but you've said it's the Jessie Buckley show. She is spine-tinglingly brilliant in it, and I can't see any other film or anyone I've seen so far that will usurp her, to use a very Shakespearean kind of phrase, to best actress, because she is terrific in it. You mentioned that thing about people saying they don't want to see it again. And, you know, I had that feeling, and it involves child death again. And maybe that's a touchstone for people not wanting to see movies, but seeing Manchester by the Sea. And even now when that comes up on the TV, I'm kind of in two minds because I love the performances, but I'm like, I don't want to do this to myself. Like, I can see the argument for not wanting to watch it again. But I guess that's not what great art... I mean, we do need to revisit it, and this is great art, so maybe I should want to watch it again.
Yeah, I might revisit it at some point down the line. I don't think I'd be going, you know, coming out of one performance and going straight into another. I think that might be, you know, you'd need a week to recover. Somewhere down the line, it is worth revisiting. I just hope people, you know, again, I to repeat myself, like, so many people thought that this was a direct Hamlet adaptation. It's not.
No.
This is something new, and this is something that is worthy of your attention, not just for Jessie Buckley's performance, but it's a phenomenal looking film. It's so well edited and directed by Chloe Zhao, who is just a wonderful filmmaker. Maggie O'Farrell, co-writing the screenplay, does terrific work to take a novel that is quite dense at times and quite lyrical and to turn it into such a powerful raw drama. And there's some great supporting performances there. I think Noah Jupe, he turns in a commendable turn as the young actor Mr. Jupe, who's hired to play Will's Hamlet. And also, if I can just say, Joe Alwyn, an actor who makes far too many headlines because of, you know, who he used to go out with. I won't mention her name here, but an actor who has made some wonderful, very smart decisions over the last few years in terms of who he's working with, and has given us some of his best performances in Kinds of Kindness, working with Yorgos Lanthimos, working with Brady Corbett in The Brutalist, and turns in a lovely performance here as Agnes's big-hearted brother Bartholomew. So there's a great supporting cast there.
Absolutely, there is. I don't want to fly in the face of this because I really did enjoy this and it stayed with me, and I've thought about it many times, and, you know, it lingers long in the memory. I did feel you mentioned that kind of pastoral scene nearly of them coming together. I did feel that was a little too slow. It dragged a little. Now, when we get up to the middle section and the end, we're off, we're flying, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. But I did find, for want of a better phrase, the opening 40, 50 minutes a little slow. Discuss.
Oh, no, I thought it was quite charming. It is quite slow. I mean, this is the filmmaker who gave us Nomadland. And you do take your time with it. Like, you know, it's like a lot of people might be going into this and thinking, oh, you know, there's going to be a big emotional impact in the very beginning. No, this is a film that very much takes its time. But I was on side with them. I was like, I think with Jessie Buckley's performance, there are a lot of other actors who might have performed her, who might have spoiled out of control a little bit and might have over-egged it in terms of, you know, the kooky sleeps among the trees aspect, in terms of the becoming a mother and giving birth in the woods to her firstborn, and then also the, you know, the horrendous loss of a child. But I always found that Buckley, and also with Mescal, you know, although he might have a lot less to do here, they're always in control. And there is this sense, and I think a lot of this is down to Zhao's direction as well. You kind of forget you're watching actors. And if that happens, that so rarely happens. I'm just thinking to myself, what's better than this? Like that is exactly what you want. You never want to see somebody acting, and I don't think you do with Buckley and Mescal.
You certainly don't. They're terrific in it. So, what are you going to say stars wise for Hamnet?
I'm going to go the perfect five here, wow. and even with. There's a piece of music, and you'll know it when you hear it, used by Max Richter here. He does the whole score, but he also digs into, you know, his back catalog for something special towards the end. And he's reusing something that's been used so many times in so many famous films, but you know what? It earns it. And it's an emotional odyssey. It's beautifully acted, so well put together. I don't think we're going to see anything better than this year. And it's only the 9th of January.
High praise indeed. Chris Wasser is giving Hamnet 5 stars. I would probably give it 4 because of what I mentioned about the opening 40-50 minutes. But Chris knows a lot more than I do. So from both of us, you should go and see Hamnet because it is in cinemas. Jessie Buckley, I think, is going to win Best Actress by a country mile, I would suggest. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Show me a hand.
What do you see?
I see you grown and very strong. And I see you in London working with your father.
In the theatre.
At the Playhouse.
What will I be doing?
What do you wish to do, Hamnet?
I should be one of the players with a sword.
Sword?
Yes. And I shall clash it against the sword of the other player.
Show me.
There'll be a terrible fight, and everybody watching will be frightened out of their wits.
And who will win?
I shall, of course.
Of course you shall.
Jessie Buckley there. In Hamnet, and it is a powerful film. I know I gave it 4 stars and Chris gave it 5, but it will last with you, and it's a great watch. And 4 stars is a lot better than most movies, so it's a great watch. It's a harrowing watch at times, but it's well worth the trip, and it is in cinemas from this Friday, the 9th of January, so do check it out. And I really do mean that. I can't see anyone else beating her to an Oscar. The Golden Globes will be on tomorrow night, and I imagine she's going to take it home there as well. That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me about anything you've been watching on the big or small screen, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. Just go to the Go Loud app, listen, subscribe, do all that good stuff. Tell your friends about it. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. Although it was coming to you on the radio at 9 this week because of the rugby. Next week on the show, as things stand, I'm going to be talking to Ben Affleck and some other cast members about his new movie opposite Matt Damon, The Rip, on Netflix. So that's all to come next week. In the meantime, I wish you a happy remainder to your weekend. We were talking about Oscar winners there. Well, possible Oscar winners in the form of Jessie Buckley. And I think Joel Edgerton, maybe even Felicity Jones will be up for Oscar nods for the Netflix movie Train Dreams, which we spoke about in December, which is a beautiful film starring Joel Edgerton and Felicity Jones. It also has some beautiful music in it. And one of those beautiful pieces of music is, I suppose, the theme tune nearly of sorts, if such a movie can have a thing, by Nick Cave with the eponymous song Train Dreams. So I'm going to leave you with that. Wish you a happy remainder to your weekend and talk to you all next week.
I've seen a grizzly big as a house walk across an open plain. Heard of a boy called Elvis something whose voice could drive young girls insane. I've seen a man from a mile away shoot a bobcat through the brain. But lately I've been having dreams.